Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark LeVonier. We have true history in this hour, and a very full one at that. Later on, a fun excerpt of Behind the Mic, where radio looked at itself in the early 1940s. Also, the news with Edward R. Murrow from 1950. But first, a broadcast of Destination Freedom, with a very interesting story called The Saga of Blanche K. Bruce, heard on WMAQ in Chicago on September 4th, 1949.
Destination Freedom. Destination Freedom. Dramatizations of the great democratic traditions of the Negro people is brought to you by station WMAQ as a part of the pageant of history and of America's own Destination Freedom. After the Great War between the states, after the victory for one Union was won and emancipation proclaimed throughout the land, there were the bold days of the Reconstruction when the spirit of Abraham Lincoln marched on to attempt a free commonwealth of freedmen in the Old South. Among the freedmen who rose out of the chaos and conflict of the era, one became a United States Senator and fought courageously to make emancipation a living reality. We tell his story in The Saga of Senator Blanche K. Bruce.
Along the docks of the river that year, the rafts and the barges and the riverboats still grunted suspiciously as they crossed the Mason-Dixon line, slowly restoring trade between North and South. And on a chilly night of 1866, the steamer Jeff Davis sidled into the docks of St. Louis, dropped anchor, lowered its plank, and its captain supervised the unloading of its cargo of timber as he had done a dozen times before. And he pushed his crew as he had always done, but for once he saw one who was not moving.
Hurry, hurry now, heave, boys, heave. Hey, you, Bruce, Bruce.
Yes, Captain.
Here's nothing. You know what to do. Grab the wood, get started.
I've finished.
What are you talking about?
My papers, Captain. They call for a year's work. The year's up. And I'm through.
Oh, I see. You're bringing that up again. Mate.
Hey, aye, sir. He's been talking of quitting since we left Cincinnati. Let him quit, and the others will think they're free, too. You hear me, Captain?
I hear you, mate.
Well, you want us to take care of him? Nobody in Nancy's seen him yet. Nobody'll ever know.
Nobody'll ever care, either.
Shall I give the boys a nod?
No, I'll wait. My reputation on the river's for being reasonable, not rough. Bruce can be reasoned with, I hope. Bruce, step up here.
Yes, Captain.
I suppose you know how demoralizing it is for the others in the crew when they work so hard and yet see one of their own rank stand idle. Such an attitude is unwise for a slave.
For a slave? I suppose it would be. But I agreed to work a year, Captain. You may not have heard, but slavery is dead.
You may not have heard, but on this boat it's very much alive. Get back to work.
I'm going ashore.
Mate.
All right, boys. Take care of him.
Let me go. Let me go. Get your hands off.
I always said, Captain, a start club just behind the ears will keep quiet the loudest. What do you think?
I don't know. One loudmouth in the crew singing about freedom could wake up the others. And there's no telling when we'll be boarded by a federal inspector and he'd sing out, I'm sure.
Why take the risk?
What do you suggest?
It's not for me to decide.
What do you suggest?
Throw him over.
If there was ever a slave who needed subduing, he's it.
Well, death can subdue any of them, Skipper.
Yeah, I know that. But since he's such a smart one, I was thinking we ought to teach him a lesson.
You want the boys to reason with him below deck when he wakes up?
No, that'd be a calm thing to do compared with what I have in mind.
What have you in mind?
In 2 days, we dock in Natchez, don't we?
Yeah, of course.
Since our educated slave's so anxious to get ashore, suppose we put him off Mississippi. Just let him free in Natchez. The night riders and angry overseers will take care of his free soul.
Skipper, I didn't think you had it in you.
Yeah, let him see how dead slavery is in Mississippi. I never did like the man. Just hold him below deck till we reach the Magnolia State.
and the steamer Jeff Davis, having unloaded timber at St. Louis, held on board one Blanche Bruce, who was brought on deck when the riverboat nudged its way into Natchez that night. When the sun came up over the bosom of the Mississippi that morning, the captain measured the former slave with his eyes.
Bruce, ordinarily, for the impudence you've shown, the river above us would have long ago been your coffin.
What other burying ground have you found?
Over there.
Where?
East. That, my rebel, is the sovereign state of Mississippi. Before the war, it had more plantations than any other in the Union. It had the most slaves, and the overseers saw to it that they had the highest death rate. His plantations produced the most...
You're telling me what I know.
I don't suppose you know what's happened over there since the war.
No.
The old masters are determined that there'll be no changes in the status of the newly freed, no matter who won the war. I don't know where you come from or what you've been before, but I gave you a chance to work out on my boat, hide out from the riots that started now that the war's over. But you ask for your freedom. This is it. Well, the plank is down. Walk it.
He walked the plank to the newly liberated city of Natchez. Newly freed wandered around the city, searching for jobs, for homes, for clothes, for a chance to grip tighter the slim margin of liberty they had won out of the war. And Bruce, the refugee, wandered and searched with them. And on a street corner, white working men idle in the aftermath of the war heard an ex-overseer pound the air and declare a new war.
Listen to me. I tell you, things has come to a star this state. When up in Washington, you got traitors. Yeah, traitors to our beloved state's rights. Right now, passing bills to give equal rights to slaves. You know what'll happen then? It means ex-slaves be calling for wages. There won't be enough jobs for the white men in Mississippi. It means slaves will be giving us orders and marrying our daughters and running and ruining this state. And you want that to happen just because Yankees with slave regiments beat us in battle? They meant protect your home. Drive the slaves back where they belong on the plantations under the whip. It's nature's law. It's meant that way. Wherever you see him, teach him the law. Ha! Ah, there goes one now. Get him. There he is. Get him.
And the Atlas turned and saw Bruce and set out after him. And he ran through the unknown streets, dodged the pellets and the stones, ducked around corners. And when he started stumbling down the end of a one-way street, he understood the captain's intentions. And he pulled up breathless under the awning of a shop window and turned to face the executioners.
Hurry, come in here. This way, hurry.
What?
I can't keep the door open. Come on.
I'm coming.
There, that'll hold them if they don't try to ram it. Come away from the window, over here. Now sit here quietly. Hey, they're going away.
Yes, they're going. You're trembling too.
I think I'm shaking more than you.
Why did you save me if you...
I guess it's your fingers. They're all smudged in printer's ink. Fingers like that, like mine. The ink never wears off. I guess it's our trade, Mark. I couldn't let them hang another printer. Be like hanging myself. If you want to, you can work here in my shop with me. Maybe we printers can bring some sanity back into the state. My hand on it.
And the printers clasped their ink-stained hands, one white and one brown. And while the mob roamed outside and spread cold terror through the town, a warm friendship sprang up between the two printers that outlasted the riot. When a calm came over the state, the printers opened shop together and took in work from the few clients who still had time to read. And it was not long before a new client came in and noticed the new printer.
Where's Martin, the printer?
He stepped out a few minutes. Can I help you?
Aren't you being a little presumptuous?
I didn't think I was.
There's nothing you can do to help me. How long will your master be gone?
All the masters have been gone for quite some time now.
I see. You're very sure the masters won't be back and put you where you belong?
Very sure.
your impudence even before the state legislature has met to pass the new Yankee amendments. I've a good mind to show you how little change there's going to be.
Mr. Cosby,
were you looking for me?
Yes, Martin, I was.
Yes, sir?
I want you to print 60,000 copies of these leaflets. Have them ready for my office in a week. Can you do it?
Well, yeah. With my new printer, I think we can.
Does he have to work on them, too?
The only way we can get them out that quickly, Mr. Cartman.
Well, all right. This helper you've got, where'd he come from?
I've never asked him, Mr. Cartman.
I've seen him somewhere before.
A lot of good people, and you here, Mr. Cartman. Take yourself, for example.
Have the order out in a week, soon if possible. Not sure that working on it might not teach a new printer a lesson. Good day, Martin.
Good day, Mr. Cartby. Well, Bruce, seems we're set for a profitable week's work.
Yes.
Hey, let me unwrap the dummy copy he left here. Cartby heads a new political party in the state. If we work for them, we don't have to worry about simple little things like food.
Let's see the copy.
Here you are. Start setting it up in the evening, and when... what is it? Can't you understand it?
Very well. No, we won't have to worry about simple things like food by printing Cartby's copy.
Then what is there to worry about?
Freedom.
The black printer handed the copy to his employer.
To all planters, overseers, ex-soldiers of the Confederacy, meet with me each night on my plantation in the next month so that we loyal sons of the South may forestall the coming election foisted upon us by Yankee armies and in which slaves are expected to vote. Meet with me and return your state to its rightful owner. Spread the news. I know what you're thinking, Bruce. You needn't look at me that way.
But printing this and putting it into their hands to spread across the state is putting a knife in the back of every free man.
Cartby's the wealthiest plantation owner left in the state. Yes. If we don't print it, he'll wreck my place. They'll see to it no work comes my way.
How do you stand on the election?
I've always wanted every man free.
I believe you. But ours is a trade that's supposed to expand the freedom you mentioned. Print these and we curtail it as sure as a planter's would.
Well, what would you suggest?
For every message of Cartby's we print, calling the ex-masters together, let's print one of our own to be distributed among the ex-slaves and calling them to register for the voting.
Yeah, it's a good thought, Bruce. Only there's one bit of difference.
Yes?
Most of the ex-slaves can't read yet. Most of the planters can. You won't reach many by print.
Then if not by print, I'll reach them with my voice. Will you go with me, Martin?
My life is here in the shop. But they say ex-slaves are gathering in camps and trying to get this state to ratify the amendments and to get the rights of the ballot. I'll stay here and print the pamphlet if you'll go out and deliver them.
Day was for printing, night was for delivery. And the black printer walked the dangerous night roads and sought out the camp of free men. The camp of Tillman Johnson and others who had furnished underground troops for the Union Army. The print shop in Natchez was busy when one evening, ex-Master Cartby and his men came by.
Well, Mr. Cartby, you're a little early.
Yes, yeah, seems some of your other customers are even earlier.
Well, what do you mean?
There's a heavy registration of ex-slaves for the voting.
Well, I suppose it's the novelty of the thing, Mr. Cartby?
It's more than the novelty, sir. Some agents are carrying messages between the camps of freedmen.
Well, it could be the carpetbaggers. Then there are some of those union soldiers...
It's someone who knows something about printing.
Well...
Someone who can imitate the size and shape of the leaflets my party's putting out. Yeah. Yes, a duplicate of my leaflet, but with a different message. Any idea where it came from?
Now, Mr. Cartby, you don't need to pull your guns in here. Every print in Natchez uses that type.
Yeah, well, that could be. Easy with the guns, men.
Yeah.
Where's this helper of yours, Martin?
Well, he's out on a delivery, Mr.
Delivering what?
Well, printing, of course.
When'll he be back?
I don't know when he'll be back. Might be late.
I see. Then it's good I have plenty of time today. Boys, make yourselves comfortable. Watch the streets. We're waiting.
And the printer finally came into the shop.
All right, boys, go over him.
Yeah. What? What is this? Hey, Martin,
hold up your hands. Hold up your hands and you'll live. Resist and you'll die. All right, go through his pockets.
Hold still there. Hold still.
The order was carried out. The men of the planter found nothing. The planter looked at him long and quietly and said,
"How long have you been in this state?"
"Long enough to believe I know what it needs."
"I've seen you before, but I can't place where." "Well, now pay attention to me, you printer. I know there are men in your trade who have prematurely hailed the Civil War's end in a system that enriches the few at the expense of the many, as you put it. But before new laws are enacted, I'm going to do everything to stop it. I know there are white laborers and farmers who might join with the freedmen to vote to keep the ex-masters from any new power, but we'll stop them, too. Don't get in the way. All right, men, come along."
These white laborers, Mr. Martin, who'll join with Negro freedmen he speaks of.
Yes, but
where can I find them?
You're not going out again tonight.
Every night.
Yeah, well, their leader's a miller named Johnny O'Hara. Holds conferences in a barn 3 miles north of Natchez.
What are you looking for?
Trade.
What kind?
I'm a printer.
Only farmers and field hands meet in here. Printers can't help us.
I can help your meeting.
How?
I can multiply your words. Spread them.
Come on in.
The printer walked inside the barn, and in the midst of the meeting of poor farmers who stared suspiciously at him while the leader speculated.
You're either a saint or a fool to risk walking out alone during these nights. Now, what is this about multiplying our words?
Print them, and thousands can know about them. I'm from a shop in Natchez.
You come just on a matter of business. Speak frankly or be on your way.
Yes, sir. Quickly, I heard you were deliberating as to whether to go ahead with the new amendments that are being proposed or to vote with the planters again.
And some of the men think we've more in common with the ex-masters than with the Negroes.
The ex-masters own 9/10 of the land in the state. Did your men own any?
No.
The ex-planters had slaves who worked free. Who did you have to work for you?
Ourselves.
Then it seems on the essentials, you didn't have much in common with the masters.
I've tried to sell them on that.
Then if you can get together and agree to meeting with leaders of the freedmen and nominating both Negro and white legislators who have a common need for freedom, I'll multiply your words on my printing press, and I'll see that they're spread.
Good. You've expanded your business, printer.
The printer's business expanded to include white farmers and Negro farmers, and to include the thousands of disfranchised of the state who called a conference to reconstruct the legislature of Mississippi. In Jackson in 1868, the convention gathered under huge tents. Men and women who 5 years earlier had never dreamed they had a common heritage and a common destination. John O'Hara presided and declared,
"This hour brings to a final end the slavery of white freedmen and Negro freedmen. I say white freedmen because no white laborer was any freer than the slaves during slavery. This hour of our gathering to carry out the program for all of us, and not the hour that ended the war, brings to an end the slave system."
And the printer recorded the speeches and multiplied them by thousands on his press. sent them across the state, and more men joined their ranks. When the elections were held that year, the ex-masters and the overseers had lost. That year, Mississippi sent its white and Negro sons to the state legislature. But the ex-masters regrouped. And again one evening, Cartby came by the printer's shop in Natchez.
Good day. What can I do for you now, Mr. Cartby?
Martin, some more printing for you.
Some of the same as before?
Not exactly. They'll read a little differently now. Now that your Negro friends and white scalawags have decided to disgrace and demoralize the good name of Mississippi by sending Negroes to the legislature.
Mr. Cartby, the last election's over.
Yes. Yes, but another is coming up, Martin. You're a printer, not a politician, and you ought to be more concerned with my copy.
I'm looking at it.
How soon can I have it?
Mr. Cartby, I don't like this kind of copy. You see, it's not...
Not what, Martin?
Not true.
Since when?
Since Mississippi outlawed segregation and we got our civil rights code. It's not legal to print copy calling for night riders to visit the homes of the new leaders, Mr. Cartby. We'll have to find another printer.
I don't think so, Martin. Not if you value your shop.
You couldn't.
No, I couldn't. No. Later, I'll be able to. Bruce's side is having its day now, but the day of the planters is coming back. Mark my words, sir. By way of the ballot, if possible. If necessary, by way of the bullet.
The printer remembered it when slowly the control of the state was turned back into the hands of the planters, and Negro freedmen and white farmers split under the strain of terror that reigned again in the Mississippi counties. It was then the freedmen leaders called the troop printers into O'Hara's mill, and they had a proposal.
We're proposing a way of uniting the people again against the ex-masters, Bruce. We're proposing you run for senator.
Yeah, that's
what you want, Bruce. I've heard you. And I've thought about
it. Then act on it, man. We need you in Washington, near the president. Show him what's happening in Mississippi. Unless we get help, we're going back to slavery.
If I thought there was a chance of winning and doing good...
We'll make the chance.
It's not like running for a seat in the House. This way it'll mean the whole state's got to be behind me.
We can get them behind you. Here, Martin, come over here. You talk to him. Bruce is your friend. He'll listen to you.
If you run, Bruce, your opponent will be Carter Cartby. You mean the plantation owner. That's right. I'll run.
Good. Now, the names of the leaders must not be spoken until the time for a nomination. Cartby's men are strong. They'll put each of us on their death list. Keep very quiet.
Who's there?
Who knows we're here?
Jump down, tell him.
And they ducked down, but some never got to know they had already been put on the death list of the ex-masters, and the rifles checked down the list and accounted for six of the Reconstruction leaders. And one broke off and dashed toward Natchez and finally threw himself on the print shop door, strength too spent to twist the lock. And this time there was no one there to open the door and snatch him into safety.
He's still breathing.
Hey, Chief, they got that Bruce table. Shall I finish her?
Wait. Hold on.
Here, let me look.
One pull of the trigger, Chief, and the Senate seat's gone without a race.
Wait. His shirt's torn.
He won't need claws in a minute.
Open his shirt some more. I see.
See what, Chief?
Never mind. I think you can put away the gun. I don't think we'll need it for this election anyway.
The man put the gun away and was puzzled. And as the days wore on and the printer seemed to survive and grow stronger, his speeches spawned new leaders to carry out the work of the Reconstruction. Then he received a visit from his opponent, Mr. Cartby.
You keep busy these days, Bruce.
Oh, it's you. What do you want?
I see here you're putting out circulars challenging me to debate with you in Jackson.
I see you've avoided answering me.
I'm trying to save you if I can.
From what?
From throwing away your life? Listen. This crazy idea of the Reconstruction is over. Oh, not this year. Next. But it's over. The police, the new Klansmen, the courts are in our hands.
I've heard.
Then why don't you give up? Come over. Join us. We can find something easy for you. What's holding you up?
I don't know. Maybe it's because these last 10 years have been, well, glorious years. We've started a new generation on the road towards a freedom they never had before. I'll see you in Jackson on the platform if you're interested in finding out why I go on.
All right. I'll accept that offer, but I'd advise you not to be there because, Bruce, I know now where I saw you before. I intend telling your prospective supporters where and how. You didn't know I knew?
Even so, I'll be there.
And in Jackson, the election crowd came to hear ex-Master Cartby as he stood upon the platform and called back at his opponent.
Gentlemen! Gentlemen! You all know me. You know, before I came to this state, I was a printer in Virginia.
That's right.
With our own sleeves.
Yeah, your own sleeves.
My record is clear, but I'd like to talk about my opponent. The radicals and carpetbaggers have never told you where he came from or what he did before he entered Mississippi. Well, I'll tell you. Will the chairman have him brought forward, please?
Well, call off your men. I'll come forward.
Well, now, that's very reasonable. Now, look, gentlemen, look. This is who the Reconstruction radicals are asking you to vote for. Would you like to know his history?
Yeah.
I'll take off his shirt and show you. Now, look. There, on his bare back, initials CC. Initials from my plantation in Virginia. He was my slave, gentlemen.
Yeah.
You're asked to vote for a runaway slave. Here, see for yourself.
The printer stood with his back bare to the shouts and calls of the crowd. And when they had subsided, Bruce spoke.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes?
May I speak?
Well, I don't see what you got to say. I don't see any real... Well, if you're not afraid they'll hang you, go on.
Move! 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 Move!
It's true, I have been a slave. And at one time, Carter Cartby was my master. But I escaped from slavery. When I came to Mississippi and saw that the old master groups were trying to renew slavery, I fought them with all I had. I've seen men go hungry and starve, and they were white as well as black, while the masters ate well. Once there were no schools for slaves. There were no schools for many of you freedmen who weren't property owners. The Reconstruction has brought you rights you never enjoyed before the war, even as freedmen. Are you to stand by and see the fruits of the Reconstruction destroyed by the owners and the masters? Now, perhaps, but not for long. No. No, the seeds of freedom lay too deep in our soil.
The crowd grew quiet and remained seated while the printer walked through the crowds of Jackson, shirt torn but spirit whole. A month later, Mississippi answered at the polls, and Blanche K. Bruce became the first ex-slave to be elected to the United States Senate. Destination Freedom has just told the story of Blanche K. Bruce, Reconstruction hero and senator from Mississippi. Destination Freedom is written by Richard Durham, produced by Homer Heck, and directed by Dick Loughran. The part of Blanche K. Bruce was played by Fred Pinkard. Our narrator was Tony Parrish. Others in the cast were Oscar Brown Jr., Ken Griffin, Jess Pugh, and Dean Almquist. special music was composed by Emil Soderstrom and played by Elwin Owen and Jose Bethencourt. Our technician was Al Johnson, sound effects by Cliff Mueller. This is Charles Martin inviting you to be with us again next week when Destination Freedom will tell the story of the 761st Negro Tank Battalion. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Destination Freedom, on Tuned to Yesterday, from the 4th of September, 1949, a syndicated broadcast originating from WMAQ. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Lipponier. Now, if you are a New York radio listener listening on the night of March 6th, 1950, a Monday, and it was 7:45 in the evening, well, it was news time on the air on some major stations. You could have heard H.V. Kaltenborn deliver his report on WNBC, Bill Lang with the news on WOR, or this broadcast with Edward R. Murrow on WCBS.
Franco-American Spaghetti brings you Edward R. Murrow with the news. Ladies, here's a wonderful get-acquainted offer. The makers of Franco-American want to pay for your first trial of Franco-American Spaghetti to prove that you'll prefer Franco-American to any spaghetti you ever tasted. Your first taste will tell you Franco-American is made from fine, firm, tender spaghetti. Yes, it's so delicious, we're sure you'll prefer it, too. And that's why we're willing to pay for your first Franco-American spaghetti. So get a can of Franco-American spaghetti and serve it to your family. Then just send us the label, together with a letter telling us how much you paid and how you liked it. Address Franco-American, Camden, New Jersey. The full purchase price of the Franco-American spaghetti will be sent you promptly. This offer is good for a limited time only, so hurry. Let us pay for your trial can. Ask for Franco-American spaghetti tomorrow. America's favorite newscaster, your Franco-American newscaster, Edward R. Murrow, is still in London tonight. We'll hear from him in a moment. Now, here's Larry Lesser.
Here's what happened today. Despite the ending of the coal strike, more persons are out of work in this country than at any time since August 1941. The government announced that unemployment rose to over 4.5 million in February. Secretary of Commerce Sawyer says it's due to an increase in the available labor force rather than layoff. There just aren't enough jobs to go round. Most of the 372,000 soft coal miners marched back to the pits today, happy over their pay boost. Almost 1 million tons of coal poured into the nation's empty coal bins. Blast furnaces started glowing again in the steel industry, and production began to speed up again in Detroit. But government officials said it would take industry 2 months to get over the 9-month contract dispute. Flushed with victory, John L. Lewis today offered $1 million in cash as a loan to the Auto Workers Union, called upon other big unions to do the same. Auto Workers President Walter Reuther is in the midst of a long strike against Chrysler Corporation for workers' pensions, a 90,000-man walkout now in its 8th week. Apparently, the mine workers' treasury didn't suffer much during the soft coal strike. The union did not pay strike benefits to the miners. It's estimated their 111 days out of work cost each miner over $1,500 in wages. In his letter to Reuther, Lewis said that in effect, the two unions are battling a common foe, what he called the financial interests associated with the group that dominates the auto industry. Lewis also made a swift move to get his 80,000 hard coal miners the same contract terms which ended the soft coal strike. Announced that negotiations with the hard coal operators would begin in Washington tomorrow, where the Senate Labor Committee quietly shelved the president's emergency bill authorizing seizure of the coal mines. Mr. Truman is described as very pleased over the strike settlement. He'll sail to Florida next week to start a 3 weeks vacation. The State Department today predicted a meeting of the big three Western foreign ministers. No date has been set. The espionage trial of Judith Copeland and Valentine Gubachev went to a federal court jury tonight. 6 men and 6 women must decide whether the two met for purposes of spying or for love. In Manchester, New Hampshire, Dr. Herman Sander disavowed any belief in mercy killing, said an obsession drove him to inject air in a patient he already thought dead. In Bulgaria, the communists wrung another confession from Michael Shipkov, who told the world how such confessions are extracted. And Paris is threatened with its first blackout since wartime. French Communist Union leaders have scheduled a strike of gas and electricity workers. The buses and subways are already seriously crippled. In London today, the King opened Parliament with a speech written for him by the Labour government. It proposed no controversial legislation, no additional nationalization. But the Conservatives immediately registered two formal objections. One, because nothing was said about new plans for the housing shortage. Two, because the King did not propose to repeal the bill nationalizing the iron and steel industry. If the law now goes into effect the first of the year, and Mr. Attlee said today his government plans to go through with it, the Conservative move could mean a test vote of confidence, and if the government, with its seven-man majority, is defeated, it could mean their downfall and a new election. Ed Morrow was in London again today because his plane couldn't leave last night. But he did get off this afternoon after recording for you a report on the opening of Parliament and an interview with Lord Wilton. Lord Wilton's views are of particular interest in view of his party's sudden action shortly after Mr. Morrow took off for home. Here's Mr. Morrow's recorded report.
This is London. On the surface, this was a day ripped from the pages of an 18th century illustrated history book. The King and Queen in full regalia, riding in the Irish coach down the Mall, passing through Admiralty Arch, turning right down Whitehall to the Houses of Parliament. They were preceded by the household cavalry. The rays of a tentative sun reached down through the morning mist to bounce off the metal trappings of the cavalry. In Parliament Square, which had been covered with gold-colored sand, the Irish guards stood like men of stone in their blue-gray greatcoats. Inside the House of Lords, the peers of the realm were gathered, their scarlet robes sliced with white ermine, their ladies in evening gowns, the dim light resting for a while on tiaras and medals. It was a great spectacle. One of the principal architects of conservative strategy, which so nearly brought them back to power, was Lord Wilton, Britain's wartime minister of food, who is now chairman of the Conservative Party, a man who was so persuasive that during the war he almost persuaded Britons that they should eat carrots instead of chocolate because it was better for them. But Lord Wilton has kindly agreed to answer a few questions regarding the present political situation in Britain. Lord Wilton, I notice that the King's speech made no mention of the nationalization of additional industries. Do you care to make any comment on this?
Well, whilst the voting was very even, you know, the country has quite definitely declared against any extension of nationalization. No government can nationalize the industries of a country without general consent. And this election shows that this consent has not been given. And whilst this parliament lasts, I believe that nationalization is dead. And I hope that when the next parliament meets, it'll be buried by a conservative government.
Well, now, Lord Wharton, would you care to make an estimate as to when the next parliament is likely to meet?
No. It's very dangerous to prophesy until you know. But it's clear that the King's government must go on. And we shall not create fractious opposition to the present administration. We shall oppose it on major issues of policy only. And then I hope that we'll put it out of action.
Well, just for a moment, I'd like to go back to the question of this last political campaign. In spite of the fact that you, the Conservatives, didn't get a majority, there was an enormous reversal of the political feeling in this country.
Yes.
Well, what do you regard as the most effective appeal that you Conservatives made to the electors?
Well, I think the reply is that they voted against socialism. Socialists believe in upsetting things. They want to nationalize our industries. They want to break down what some of us regard as a rather glorious set of traditions. They want to create a state-controlled population, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Well, the people in this country, and the countrymen in particular, well, they don't want their land nationalized because they look forward to owning some land of their own sometime. They voted against the government. And then the small men in business look to the time when they'll be able to become the possessors of bigger business. They voted for the Conservatives. And the women of England realize that whilst they have a socialist government, the cost of living goes up and is likely to continue to go up. And the general public realize that all these theories about a new state haven't worked out in practice. And so I consider that two main factors were involved. Antisocialism on the one hand, and the rising cost of living on the other. These are the things that got us what you are good enough to call a reversal of public opinion.
Well, Lord Wharton, in this period of delicate balance in the House of Commons, and referring again to your earlier phrase that the king's government must go on, does this mean that in the field of foreign affairs, your government will be unable to act firmly and decisively?
Oh, no. Oh, no. We've always tried to keep foreign affairs outside of our party conflicts in this country. Britain's position face to face with Western Europe and the United States is not a partisan policy. It's a national policy. In the field of foreign policy, there may indeed be even more unity in this parliament than in the last. On fundamentals, Mr. Bevin, in the last parliament, was challenged only by a small group of Labour and Communist members who were swept away in the recent election. International commitments are binding on the British government, whatever party is in power.
Well, Lord Wharton, a moment ago we were talking about the reversal of opinion in this country, but why did the Socialists get so many votes?
The reason why the Socialist Party polls so many votes, believe me, has nothing to do with socialism. The answer? Well, it's this. The full pay packet. We've had full employment in this country since the war. Partly because of the big backlog of demand all over the world, and partly, let's face it, as a result of the generosity of the United States of America. Labour voters in this election thought that we were inviting them to shoot Santa Claus. Well, full employment has nothing to do with socialism. It's due to the circumstances of the time.
Word, he got votes. Lord Wharton, what about the relative ages of the Conservative and Labour members of Parliament?
Well, we're a younger party in age. It's quite true that Mr. Churchill is 10 years older than Mr. Attlee. Now, by the way, he's had 10 more years of experience of life than Mr. Attlee as well. Last week, I met all the new Conservative members of Parliament. You know, they're a young and very lot of fellows. They're so good. And they're the people who are now leading a crusade in this country. It's a crusade for the spirit of free enterprise. It was on that spirit that Great Britain was built. It's that spirit that'll rescue it from socialism. And it's that spirit that'll restore it to independence.
Well, now, Lord Wharton, when are you coming over to my country and see something of our free enterprise?
Well, the weather's so beautiful in this country today. It's quite glorious. I've been wanting to come to America for a long time. It's no use talking to people in this country. When are you coming to America? Because one of the first things that you've got to do is to say, how can I afford to live in America when I get there, when this country won't let you have any dollars?
Well,
I think I shall come when I can find some dollars.
I should imagine that could be arranged. Thank you very much indeed, Lord Wharton, for coming along and answering these questions this afternoon. This is Ed Murrow, recording from London. Now back to Bob Dixon in New York.
Ladies, during the Lenten season, serve your family Franco-American spaghetti. It's economical, nourishing, and ready to serve in 5 minutes. And so good, thousands of families actually prefer it to home-cooked spaghetti. No wonder that of all ready-to-serve spaghetti, 9 out of 10 people who taste it prefer Franco-American. So when you shop, remember, for delicious Lenten meals that cost mere pennies a portion,
you just can't beat Franco-American. Cannot beat Franco-American, just can't beat Franco-American. 9 out of 10 will agree.
Now here's Ed Murrow's word for today.
Well, Bob, I should be in New York now, but last night as our plane was at the end of the runway ready to take off, the pilot came back and announced that something was wrong with the de-icing apparatus on his windshield. And he said he was sure no one would want him to go into the field at Shannon and Gander when he couldn't see through the windshield. A Frenchman sitting opposite me leaned over and said, a most philosophic statement. Basically, the trouble with the world. Really, the basis of the Cold War. The de-icing equipment is faulty, and no one can see where they're going. Good night, and good luck.
Tune in your Franco-American newscaster, Edward R. Murrow, immediately following Dick Hames Club 15 over most of these stations at this time tomorrow.
Blow the whistle and get on the track of Campbell's Pork and Beans. Cause once you try them, you'll never go back to any other bean. Campbell's are top, so get them today. Give them a try and you're going to save for flavor and zest. The beans that are best are Campbell's Pork and Beans.
Millions buy them, try them, and never go back to ordinary beans. Get the best. Get Campbell's Pork and Beans.
Listen tomorrow, tomorrow. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The news with Edward R. Murrow on Tuned to Yesterday from March 6, 1950 on CBS. The man Murrow interviewed was one Frederick James Marquis, known as the first Earl of Wilton and referred to as Lord Wilton in that role. He was actually a very powerful figure during the Second World War in England. When he was named head of the Ministry of Food in 1940, he oversaw over 50,000 employees at over 1,000 offices across the country through 1943, and it was ultimately up to him how the food rationing was to be handed down. And as alluded to in the interview we just heard, he was the Conservative Party chairman in England from 1946 through 1955. We wrap up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday with a recreation during radio's yesteryear of one of radio's older shows. The NBC Blue Network brings us behind the mic. This excerpt from January 19th, 1941.
Behind the Mic salutes a program you loved. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud. A tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. And so each week we bring you a star or part of a program you used to hear. A program that you loved. Now this afternoon we salute WJZ's first commercial program, The Man from Cook's. Sponsored by the famous travel agency, Thomas Cook & Son. Written by and featuring Malcolm LaPrade. This program started in April 1925 and ran continuously until the spring of 1939. Now with Malcolm LaPrade in person, we present a portion of that program, The Man from Cook's. This particular program dates back 8 or 9 years. Ladies and gentlemen, Malcolm LaPrade.
One of the great attractions of traveling in Europe is this. The complete change of scene adds a new interest to everything you do, even to such routine matters as 3 meals a day. Now, suppose we look over the map of Europe for a few characteristic settings that give special flavor to breakfast, luncheon, and dinner. To the average American, his cup of coffee is the most important breakfast item. And you may have heard that it's impossible to get a good cup of coffee in Europe. Vienna is an outstanding exception to the rule. Good coffee is universal in this historic city, which, after all, introduced coffee drinking to Europe and to America via Europe. This happened more than 250 years ago when the Turkish armies laid siege to Vienna and camped around its walls. Eventually, they were forced to retreat and did it so hurriedly that they left behind them most of their equipment and supplies. Among these were bags of coffee beans, fine Arabian coffee, favorite beverage of those old Turkish generals. Now, a certain Viennese pastry cook got hold of a bag of coffee, and he baked a lot of rolls shaped like crescents. And through the streets of Vienna, he went carrying his tray from door to door, inviting the people to drink the Turkish drink and to eat the Turkish emblem to celebrate victory. Coffee and crescent rolls at a cafe on the Ringstrasse. A table on the balcony of your favorite cafe, where you can watch the crowds go by and enjoy the atmosphere of this city, which can never forget that it's the home of the waltz. And when you're there, something of the rhythm of the beautiful Blue Danube gets into your bones, yes, even into your breakfast. Now for luncheon, a luncheon with pictures, let's hop across the map to Belgium, famous for good cookery. 17 miles south of Brussels, on the edge of the field of Waterloo, there's a little tavern where they know how to serve a typical Belgian lunch. And you'll look out over the rolling wheat fields where the most dramatic pitched battle of history was fought 125 years ago. Off to the southwest, on a little hill, seated on his white horse and surrounded by a few staff officers, you will see Napoleon, watching with troubled eyes the heroic efforts of his cavalry to break the British squares. 4,000 men in steel breastplates surging around immovable rocks of infantry. and you'll hear the sound of the bagpipes, and you'll see the kilties of the Black Watch rise up and swarm down the hill after the retreating French, hanging to the stirrups of their own Scots Greys. You'll have a glimpse into the past, a mighty panorama of action floating over these fields of wheat that are so quiet and peaceful today. Venice is an ideal setting for dinner. Dinner at Florian's on St. Mark's Square, a restaurant that hasn't closed its doors for more than 300 years. Make it a late dinner with a moonlight view of this square, the most harmonious collection of ancient buildings in all the world. The pigeons have all gone to roost now among the domes of St. Mark's Church, except for the clothes of the people who sit at the cafe tables and walk about the square. This picture belongs to 1,000 years ago, to the days when the Venetian galleys sailed up the Grand Canal with their cargoes of silks and spices from the east. Dinner in the moonlight on St. Mark's Square.
Yes, we all remember those travel hours with the man from Cook's. And we remember how pleasant it was to go to Europe in those days. Do you think it'll ever be the same again, Mr. Laprade?
Yes, I do, Tiny. Nothing can end the romance of travel. Europe will again be Europe. There'll always be an old world.
And the man from Cook's to tell us about it, I sincerely hope. Thank you, Malcolm Laprade, for recreating such a fine program.
An excerpt of the NBC Blue Network program Behind the Mic from the 19th of January, 1941. And so closes this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.